From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The prison population of the United States rivals that of any other industrialized nation. State and federal prisons and jails house millions of Americans in harsh conditions. Among the abuses that incarcerated Americans face is the pervasive use of psychotropic drugs. Now a new book by Anthony Ryan Hatch exposes how shockingly large numbers of facilities routinely violate human rights through drug use. Anthony Ryan Hatch is an associate professor in the Science and Society program at Wesleyan University, whose earlier book was called Blood Sugar, Racial Pharmacology and Food Justice in Black America. He now joins me to discuss his latest book, Silent Cells, The Secret Drugging of Captive America. Welcome back, Anthony. We had you on for your last book. It's good to have you back on.
Thank you for having me.
So it's not an aspect that is discussed that often about prisons and jails in the United States. We talk about solitary confinement or, you know, in general in terms, the healthcare that prisoners receive. How did you get started on this journey to explore how psychotropic drugs are used to pacify inmates, or I want to sort of paraphrase from your book where you quoted a report, they're used as chemical straitjackets?
Yeah, the part of the what intrigued me about this project was this, the silence about this issue. I had studied medicine for years, had some previous contact with the prison system as a researcher, and had heard very little about the use of psychotropic drugs in prisons, or really any other medicine in prison. I knew that healthcare costs were rising for prisons, because of the number of people that were there, and in part because of the aging of the prison population. But several years ago, I participated in a fellowship at the Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. And as part of that fellowship, I got to meet with and heard a presentation from a former prison psychiatrist who had worked in the Georgia Department of Corrections. And she, you know, told us about what they were doing in terms of mental health in prisons and the challenges they faced. And at the end of her presentation, I asked her what she thought about the use of psychotropic drugs in U.S. prisons. And she kind of laughed, smirked, and rocked back on her heels and said, "Well, let me put it to you this way. Each year, the warden sends me and my staff a nice bottle of something because he knows we keep the prisons quiet." And for me, that was back in 2009. And that statement, that claim, put me off on the journey to try to understand, you know, was she right? Were prisons using these medicines for bad reasons, for the wrong reasons, for non-medical reasons? Were they using them to silence inmates and keep things quiet? And so that, you know, began a years-long investigation of that, of the practice. But it was partly because I had, didn't see much in the research literature about it that it became really intriguing.
So in a way, that word silent cells has a double meaning. There's silence around the drugging of captive America, and the drugging is literally used to silence prisoners?
That's right. I mean, that the double meaning, you know, was one that kind of hung in my mind from the very beginning. It was very difficult to find information, public information, about these practices, about the provision of mental health care, if you want to call it that, in prisons. I traveled to the National Library of Medicine in Bethesda, researched all the relevant databases, all the books, and there just really wasn't much coming out. The government had produced a few reports here and there, but the kind of the scattered information that was available painted a really partial picture. Of course, independent journalists and other researchers occasionally would publish stories about, you know, things that were happening locally. But there was really no comprehensive picture of what was going on. So that kind of overwhelming silence institutionally, the silence around knowledge, became to me all the more important, because it's that silence around knowledge that allows them to do what they do with bodies themselves, in my opinion.
So let's talk about specifically what drugs you cover. Psychotropic drugs, it's a generalized term. I mean, there are, of course, people in the free population who rely on these drugs to function. So what are the drugs that we're talking about here? And don't those who are incarcerated also have legitimate needs for such drugs?
Of course. Psychotropic drugs, the term psychotropic is an umbrella term that covers and includes antidepressants, like your kind of SSRIs, which are widely known, antipsychotic drugs, which are often very powerful drugs to use to treat psychosis, mood stabilizers, other depressants. There are, you know, several subclasses of compounds that are included under this category, and these are, you know, medicines that are at least part of the design is intended to treat people who have suffer from psychic distress, psychiatric disorder, and the like. And it is true that among persons who are incarcerated, there is great need for mental health care and service, from, you know, the need for adequate evaluation and surveillance to the need for adequate treatment. Just to tell you, the most recent data we have on this practice comes from 2011, 2012, and, 29.9% of prisoners, were in state and federal prisons were taking, a psychotropic drug to treat, some problem. And again, some mental health problem. Only 19% of prisoners were taking both a drug and receiving some kind of counseling. So in many institutions, if inmates are able to get access to these drugs, they are going to not necessarily be using them in the ways that are accordance with gold standard practices out here.
Is there a possibility that the higher than average use of these drugs simply reflects the fact that the trauma of, you know, being captive is something that triggers, you know, symptoms that these drugs are necessitated? Or is that you found specific sort of informal policies to mass, you know, prescribe these drugs?
No, that question riddled me throughout this process of researching this topic. You know, what is a legitimate medical use of a psychotropic drug in a prison? The boundary between what constitutes a therapy or a treatment and what constitutes a punishment is a very thin boundary and a porous boundary and a blurry boundary in prisons. Prison itself was once understood as a form of kind of moral therapy for the person who was incarcerated, from the very architecture of the prison to all the various technologies that were in the prison that were used to kind of control the body of the person who was incarcerated. So in many ways, psychotropic drugs become yet another kind of tool or technology that prisons use to kind of mold persons who are incarcerated. And it's true that prison itself is a stressful environment and it produces its own psychosis. But it became very difficult for me to determine and ascertain, well, in what context is this use appropriate? In what context is this use inappropriate or immoral or unconstitutional?
So then it becomes maybe less about the prisoner's need and more about the prison administrator's policy, right? Because it's hard to sort of tell unless you have a comprehensive survey of what inmates feel, and it's maybe easier to tease out what it is that what these policies are. And I want to go back to what you said earlier about the particular example where somebody was being thanked for keeping the prison quiet and safe and calm. What did you find in your research about policies in place for the use of these psychotropic drugs among healthcare providers in prisons?
Well, strictly speaking, as a matter of law, prison officials cannot use psychotropic drugs to sedate, to silence, say, political prisoners or people, prisoners with whose opinions bother them, that they can't use these drugs. They're not supposed to be using these drugs in these ways. Part of what I found was that there is no audit mechanism in place to evaluate whether or not a prison is following their own rules. You know, it's only through legal cases that prisoners are able to contest what prisons are doing. Occasionally, a story leaks out through the independent media of abuses that take place. But the government is not necessarily, the prison system is not necessarily collecting data on for itself on whether or not and to what extent it's adhering to the recommended mental health policies and practices that are on the books. That was one of, I think, the most shocking findings for me, is looking at, you know, what do prisons see when they look at themselves? For example, you know, with a colleague, Renee Shelby, we examined a series of several dozen audits that prisons conducted of themselves and when they looked at their own pharmacy systems. So they're looking at inventory, record keeping, expenditure and waste in the prison pharmacy. And, you know, if the idea is that you could go there to determine whether or not a prison is following its own rules, they had poor record keeping, bureaucratic errors and mistakes and all over the place. It was the prison pharmacy was a kind of a sham. So it became very difficult to ascertain what is a legitimate use and what is an illegitimate use, because they're not collecting the data on it.
Now, in your book, Silent Cells, The Secret Drugging of Captive America, one of the more shocking things that I found was the way in which you've had drug testing on prisoners. It seems as though we just throw out all rules and laws and ethical boundaries when it comes to inmates, right? We have, you know, we somehow can pay them a few cents per hour for work. Prison labor is, you know, pretty close to slave labor these days. And similarly, drug testing, it seems, is something where ethical boundaries are violated.
They were. And, you know, I became concerned with and curious about, when did drugs first enter the prison, right? If this is what we're, if what we're facing now looks like this, when did this all begin? And I was, again, surprised to learn that American pharmaceutical firms had their footprint in prisons as back as early as the 1930s and 40s, when they were just getting off the ground. They literally had their birth in prisons. And for decades, they relied on prisoners' bodies to run their clinical studies. Of course, in the early 20th century, to call these studies, to call them science, isn't exactly fair. You didn't have ethical norms in place, any kind of ethical standard as to what you should or shouldn't do with prisoners. Prisoners were exposed to all sorts of risky compounds. According to one FDA commissioner in the 1970s, he estimated that between 1962 and 1980, prisoners comprised 90% of the research subjects in phase one and phase two trials. And those are the safety and efficacy trials, right, to determine how much of this can we give somebody before it's a problem. Pardon me, not efficacy, for toxicity. So, there were drug companies building, 10,000 square foot research facilities on prison grounds in the mid 1960s, 20 years after the Nuremberg trial, where it was supposedly argued that we shouldn't be doing any testing whatsoever on people who are incarcerated who can't fully give their consent. And so there was extensive testing done. I was, of course, interested in whether or not psychotropics had been tested in the prison. And the FDA did not request for information on whether or not particular subjects were prisoners when they approved a drug. So it was, fascinating and difficult to kind of dig into that history. But this is a history I didn't know.
Now, is there a difference in that you could find in the rates of psychotropic drug prescriptions in federally run prisons versus, say, private prisons, or versus, say, state run prisons?
Right. It depends on the population. Let me just address the question about the private prisons. In some of the prison pharmacy audits that were conducted, state governments looked at whether or not they were, you know, saving any money by, you know, using in their private prisons. And the answer, of course, was no. Private prisons did not necessarily offer them any, the state any savings in terms of pharmacy and prescription costs. They have a smaller incentive to provide what can be very expensive medications. I should mention that in particular, the second generation antipsychotic medications are very expensive for the government. And so they're looking for every way to not provide those. States and the federal government are spending tons of money, you know, tens of millions of dollars a year on pharmaceuticals for people who are incarcerated, and it doesn't seem as if those rates are demonstrably higher in privately run prisons as opposed to publicly run ones. Although, the entire apparatus, the entire infrastructure of drug distribution in prisons is a privately run, partly privately run enterprise. You have all sorts of drug companies, intermediaries, public-private partnerships that mediate the exchange of all of these tens of millions of dollars in pharmaceuticals. So the public-private distinction doesn't make as much sense to me, given how intertwined corporations are with the apparatus of the prison.
Right. That's such a great point. I mean, when we talk about healthcare in general in America, the pharmaceutical industry and its thirst for profits is often a guilty party. And in a way, it seems as though prisons and their thirst for psychotropic drugs is just a great financial bonanza for these companies, right? They're only too happy to keep selling lots of these drugs to our facilities. And the federal government, which has long favored private interests and corporations, is probably only too happy to buy them at taxpayer expense. And the captive America pays the price.
You know, that it's the broader context that began to disturb me when I began to zoom out from just looking at prisons, but to looking at the other institutions, state institutions where people are kind of held captive. So looking at nursing homes and the use of psychotropic drugs in nursing homes to control our elders, the use of psychotropics in the foster system to control and kind of transform our most vulnerable youth, to the active duty military. You know, I was, again, another shocking story for me was to learn when the U.S. government decided it would be a good idea to start shipping psychotropics out into the live war zone, which was a policy decision they made, of course, after the invasion of first Afghanistan and then Iraq in the 2000s. And to start shipping them out into the war zone to help keep soldiers on the battlefield. So once I began to zoom out, you start to see that the government is purchasing really vast quantities of psychotropics from pharmaceutical companies for distribution to various citizen and non-citizen populations for a whole range of reasons. And it just all started to look very sinister and dark to me.
Would you say that we've unfortunately become a society where psychotropic drugs are used to make people in many various capacities and parts of our country accept things that are hard to accept? I mean, if you look at active duty military people who are in war zones, or even prisoners who are forced into captivity for far too many years or in solitary confinement, we, in a way, you know, have to get them to use drugs to force their human selves to accept subhuman treatment or subhuman conditions.
You know, in the book, Sonali, I used the language of the brilliant legal theorist Patricia Williams, who calls this, and I use her term spirit murder to describe what's going on. And, you know, Williams describes this as a disregard for those whose lives qualitatively depend on our regard, that we are disregarding, disposing of large numbers of human beings, and using these drugs to transform their consciousness, to transform them so that they can impart, as you suggest, you know, live through really traumatic experiences, but I think there's something broader, and that is that the technology isn't just used, the drug isn't just used to sedate those persons. It's also used to keep an entire social structure in place. The technology has a world-building quality to it, right? We have to have a system in which the technology can be used. And so we keep institutions in place that really should be transformed, the prison being one of them. You know, everybody, you know, who's looked at it with clear eyes recognizes we need to abolish this prison system that we have. But psychotropics help prop up the system. They make it seem as if it's involving, you know, therapy and treatment. When in fact, it's not only doing that. We have unending war, but psychotropics allow us to keep soldiers on the battlefield for longer. You know, we don't adequately care for our youth and elders and for migrants coming across our border. So we use these technologies to keep unjust policies in place. And so I think it's both a kind of domination over those who the least among us, but it also has this kind of dangerous world-building quality that I fear needs our attention.
Well, Anthony, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and for shining a light on this issue. Really appreciate having you on.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Anthony Ryan Hatch, an associate professor in the Science in Society program at Wesleyan University. His earlier book was Blood Sugar, Racial Pharmacology and Food Justice in Black America. We've been discussing his newest book, Silent Cells, The Secret Drugging of Captive America. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.